Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Herb Hurwitz to get his take on where we are and where we're headed in management of colorectal cancer, and he began our conversation by commenting on adjuvant therapy.
The debate is whether or not lymph node negative or Dukes B2 patients benefit from therapy. I usually handle that fairly complicated discussion by a long discussion with the patient, namely that there probably is a similar relative benefit for those patients, although because the absolute risk is smaller, the absolute benefit is also smaller but may still be present. For patients who have good performance status, where a few percentage points of improvement in overall survival would be worth the 6 months of chemotherapy, I walk them through what the side effects are, as well as the potential benefit and the need to monitor patients during therapy. So in case side effects do become unacceptable, therapy can be discontinued. That's usually how I approach the most complicated setting of whether or not the B2 patients are appropriate.
What about patients with node-negative disease without any high risk factors, adequate number of lymph nodes? Do you discuss adjuvant therapy?
I'm not sure that we're able to subset patients well enough or that any of the negative prognostic features clearly validate that therapy is more useful. While in general benefit from adjuvant therapy has correlated with risk, that does not necessarily apply to all risk modifiers. And there's the old saying that bad disease is sometimes refractory to treatment. While I think that some of these negative prognostic features, lymphovascular invasion and perhaps some molecular characteristics, may pose patients who are at higher risk, it's not necessarily clear that therapy will work as well. It's even plausible that it may work better in some of those patients than the average Dukes B patient. For that reason, I usually explain to the patient there are lots of things which are uncertain in medical practice. Many answers the patient will need to come back in 10 or 15 years once we've established the answer, which is obviously impractical. And I think this represents a theme which I think you've spent time on, which is how do we communicate with patients and how do we make decisions when we have imperfect information for every last variable that may or may not be of interest to the patient.
One of the things that we saw in that survey that we did of patients who'd had adjuvant therapy was a real heterogeneity, how people saw these. You know, we saw a bunch of people, and our survey was about a third, who said they go through chemotherapy again for a 1% reduction in relapse rate. But then we saw about 12% of people who wouldn't go through chemotherapy again, even for a 10% absolute benefit. How does that contrast to what you see in your practice?
Yeah. I see the same heterogeneity, and I would expect that most physicians see the same differences. What's difficult is trying to tease out which patients truly have belief systems which put them at the polar extremes of, I never want it, really, doctor, I really never want it no matter how much it helps. And on the other hand, I want it no matter what. I call this, you know, sort of my analogy is to the Dr. Seuss book of Green Eggs and Ham, where the protagonist of that story says, I don't want it, no way, no how. And then once they've had it and have a better idea of what they're getting into, then they can actually change their mind. And I think that's one of the important parts to these sorts of complicated discussions, that we tailor the information to a context that the patient can understand. This may actually require more than one visit, may require interaction with family members, because there are a lot of preconceived notions and biases which patients have, and to be honest, which doctors have, either for or against therapy, and being sure that the doctor and the patient are on the same page, both at the beginning of treatment and during treatment, so that the value of therapy managed against the risks and ongoing side effects can be optimized for that patient.
How do you feel as a physician when you encounter people at both ends of the spectrum, the patient who's desperate to be treated, you know, even if the benefit is really, you know, modest, the patient who doesn't want to be treated even when the benefit maybe in our eyes is pretty significant?
Yeah. At the end of the day, I believe my job as a physician is to try to offer patients the best therapy that's right for them. There are many settings where benefit in terms of longevity or disease control is not the patient's primary outcome. Many of us who grew up with working class families where family members would do jobs which carry high risk were in fact, well, never was my case, fortunately, there are people who work in coal mines and other high-risk jobs where everyone knowingly is probably sacrificing several years of their life in order to put a few dollars in the bank and some food on the table. One can easily say that the risk-benefit of what we're talking about, purely from a financial point of view, where the amount of money for therapy clearly is more than what people may make or be able to save in a whole lifetime, would, on that metric alone, not be something they would like to choose if indeed they had an alternative choice. In the same way, I think people look at side effects and quality of life in the same way, where a lot has to do with how they want to live their lives, including issues which are very hard to quantify, such as autonomy and or just being left alone. For this reason, this type of discussion can be very time-consuming. I'm not sure there's an easy way around it. I think most doctors over the course of time, and hopefully physicians are motivated and have this by instinct to start and quickly develop the skill to try to figure out what patients indeed want and to be able to validate that so that these balances can be struck.
Are there any sort of demographic factors that in your experience seem to correlate with these attitudes, particularly age?
No, I've not found that there's any one factor that drives this. What I have found is that there's a remarkable amount of consistency once things are explained to patients. I think the times I've seen inconsistency have more to do with either my explanations not being optimal when I started or perhaps their understanding of the patient's perception of what I think I said wasn't exactly as what I thought I might have meant. I don't think there's a demographic like age per se. I do think people who are at later parts of their life, and particularly the elderly, will look at balance between quality of life and particularly autonomy differently than those who are younger, where there really is not a risk to autonomy. So if you get sick and you're living alone and are elderly, even mild additional illness may compromise your ability to live alone. Those types of considerations, I think, have more to do with what's generally called the performance status or other things about the patient rather than age per se.
What about, you know, one of the things that's interesting that I've observed comparing colon cancer to breast cancer is that in breast cancer, when you get into the lower risk node negative situation where the absolute benefits aren't as great, people tend to dial down the intensity of therapy. For example, they tend to not use taxanes. Whereas in colon cancer, it seems like at least the clinical investigator community either is going to use an oxaliplatin-containing regimen, FOLFOX, or not. How do you approach that question? And for example, do you utilize, say, capecitabine in a lower risk situation?
Yeah, great questions. These are actually exactly the issues which I'll discuss with the patient. And there are settings where patients who have pre-existing neuropathy or who have careers or lifestyles where neuropathy would be a major quality of life adjustment, I'll let them know that they really have two options. FOLFOX, which probably has a slightly superior outcome, or capecitabine as monotherapy, or if for some reason that would not be available, 5-FU, is probably better than nothing from the point of view of disease control and survival. Similar to the discussion before, that benefit may not be worth therapy at all to the patient. In the same way, there may be trade-offs they want to make in between. A lot of this also has to do with trying to figure out whether or not resources at home can be marshaled, and whether or not there are approaches to the introduction of therapy that can minimize what I call the first window where patients get to know what the side effects are. So as you've hinted, they can then make a more informed decision about whether or not, in fact, continuation of therapy is what they still want to do. The starting of therapy, I think, is an issue where everyone has to be on the same page about the likely trade-offs. But in classic Bayesian fashion, whatever your prior probabilities or expectations are, those are significantly informed by how the first couple weeks of therapy go. And what I like to reassure patients is that however those initial weeks go, if the side effects are too severe, then therapy may need to be discontinued permanently. If they're moderate, we should be able to adjust the doses. And certainly if the side effects are mild, in all likelihood, the trade-off of starting therapy and continues to reinforce the initial value of the decision to start treatment in the first place.
Can you talk a little bit about how you monitor for neuropathy? How do you adjust your therapy based on what you observe?
I find the easiest way to monitor for neuropathy is a good questioning of the patient. In classical fashion, by which we were all trained, you start with an open-ended question and then probably need to have 2 to 4 more specific questions about how they're being affected functionally.
So specifically, what would you say?
I use metrics like, are you having any difficulty buttoning your clothes? Are you, in fact, changing the clothes that you're using to ones that don't require as much manipulation? Is your handwriting, or if they do things with a computer, is your typing starting to be affected? Have you dropped anything, or have you tripped in the last bit?
Now, any kind of, hint towards some type of motor problem like that, would that get you to stop therapy?
Yeah, sensory or motor. And then, again, very consistent with very usual ways of handling symptom assessment, if you start to see a little bit of trouble, you start to interrogate more closely and you tailor your exam to be more detailed. And then if I find that they're actually having a real problem, if it's still mild, we'll monitor fairly aggressively with the anticipation I'll likely need to either reduce or stop oxaliplatin. And if they're having very little symptoms, then things can sort of be monitored. And in fact, after a few visits, patients become more adept at self-assessment because now they have a better idea of what they're actually looking for.
Now, with this type of very aggressive follow-up and monitoring of patients and taking into consideration what you're seeing in terms of the reports from Mosaic and other reports, what would you say to a patient who says, in your hands, doctor, what's my chance that I'm going to have a problem 2-3 years from now?
Yeah, I let patients know that the likelihood that they'll have some tingling at the end of therapy will be the rule, not the exception. I also let them know that most of them will have whatever neuropathy that's present at the end of therapy. It may persist for a couple months, but by a year, most people should have almost all of it resolved. But there will be a few people who will have a lot of trouble that may even lead to a functional impairment that may persist for a year or even longer. And while those are a small minority, everyone needs to be aware of that in order to make an informed choice.
What fraction of patients that you yourself start on FOLFOX get through the whole regimen?
I think the six-month period, probably 80-90% will get through with full therapy. It may be that toward the end, since there's a defined limit to therapy, how to manage grade 2, so-called, has a little bit of variability and very often will sort of round off to the six-month mark rather than sort of cutting short. And that may be an artifact of having a defined endpoint as opposed to metastatic therapy where we're still working our way through about whether to stop based on the calendar threshold of symptoms or a problem level of symptoms.
Now, you mentioned the option of capecitabine monotherapy. How do you dose that?
Most patients in the United States will start with the dose of 1,000 milligrams per meter square as monotherapy and then adjust up if they don't have any problems during the first cycle. For some of the reasons I've mentioned, I think the initial start of therapy is sort of a window where the doctor, the patient, the family are all trying to figure out how to monitor and manage any side effects. And if that's done well, then a lot of the risks related to hand-foot syndrome for capecitabine or diarrhea or really any side effect, I think that risk can be reduced significantly by better education, which is why my bias is in patients who I'm not sure about how to dose to start slightly lower. For patients with excellent performance status, starting at the full dose of 1250 per meter square BID is also very reasonable. Adjuvant therapy takes a lot of time because the details matter a lot because that's a setting where there's the potential for cure. There are suggestions that dose intensity may matter. and therefore skimping on treatment or dose unnecessarily may, for a few patients, affect whether or not their cancer will return. Now, while that's likely a small number of patients, from my point of view, that raises a fairly significant ethical imperative to be sure that as many details go right as possible. I don't think taking care of patients is rocket science. I think much of cancer treatment, as well as general internal medicine, has to do a lot with how you extract information from the patients, how you listen to them, and how you educate them. And I'm very lucky by having a very good team of nurse practitioners, other colleagues, nurses, and a wonderful facility where much of that educational message can be conveyed. And I don't think there's anything terribly unique that I, as a physician, can provide. I think the biggest issue is that whatever the message is, that it's conveyed often and reinforced.
How do you go about following people after they've had adjuvant therapy? And what do you say to them in terms of the concept of, is there sort of a watershed point at which they can start to relax? You know, there was some data presented at ASCO this year addressing that question in terms of the natural history of the disease.
Most patients will follow every 3 to 4 months for about 3 years and then space things out to about every 6 months thereafter. The highest risk of recurrence is within the first 2 to 3 years, and after that, there's still some risk. The issue of worry really is in the eye of the beholder, much like what you've mentioned around what amount of risk would patients be willing to undergo adjuvant therapy at all. Many of the same considerations can be applied to how much, quote unquote, should you worry, or how much follow-up should be maintained and for what duration. In an era with increasingly active therapy for metastatic disease, which can affect survival, and more importantly, with increasing evidence to support a potentially curative resection of isolated metastases, I think the issue of follow-up is something which is important because that, again, is one opportunity for potential cure.
Maybe we should talk a little bit about the issue of people who present with potentially surgically curable metastases. Can you talk a little bit about how you approach those patients in a non-protocol setting?
So management of patients with potentially curative metastatic disease, the most important issue is probably multidisciplinary care. There has to be a lot of discussion with the surgeon who is also experienced in that kind of surgery. Outcomes, morbidity, all track with surgical experience. Now, the difficulty is often getting everything arranged between all the CAT scans, the PET scan. One may need an MRI or some additional tests, and that can be a bit of a burden, but there's probably no way around that. In general, I think there are two potential approaches. One is to resect the patient as soon as disease is considered potentially resectable for cure. And if that's at the time of de novo presentation, that can be at presentation without any prior chemotherapy. The issue then is what additional chemotherapy to give afterward. I don't think there's any clear answer to that. There is data supporting the use of FOLFOX pre- and post-liver met resection, for which there's a trend for improved benefit consistent with the benefit of adjuvant therapy for Duke C patients. That is that there is a survival benefit to surgery plus chemo as opposed to surgery alone. That doesn't define what chemo or what duration. I make the extrapolation that patients should be treated with best first-line therapy, which is usually 5-FU combined with either oxaliplatin or irinotecan plus bevacizumab. Therapy should not be started until patients have healed up from their surgery.
Which would be how long?
For liver resection, a lot depends on how much liver was removed. Most liver regeneration will occur within 1 to 2 months. And given the size of the surgery, most patients are probably not ready for therapy before 6 weeks. So usually it's sort of a 4 to 8 week target, but the vast majority of patients are probably around the 8 week post-op mark when they're ready to actually start combination chemotherapy. The other question is duration, which I don't think is settled. And one way I approach this is to see how the patient tolerates treatment, of course. But most patients with metastatic disease, particularly with favorable biology, where most patients are on treatment for 9 to 10 months on average, and we'll extrapolate that those who are doing well will be on therapy for about a year, I usually round up to a target of about a year of total therapy. Much like current adjuvant studies, AVANT and the NSABP studies, one may need to adjust the chemotherapy around the six-month mark, particularly with oxaliplatin, where treatment with that agent beyond 6 months becomes problematic. But continuing 5-FU or 5-FU with bevacizumab to the year mark is, I think, a hybrid approach consistent with the adjuvant studies and common practice in the first-line setting.
What about preoperative systemic therapy, both in the patient who starts out looking surgically curable or in patients who are starting out looking surgically incurable?
Right. So the other branch to the algorithm is to treat patients with chemotherapy for some period of time and then go through surgery. There are some pros and cons to that approach. The advantage is you have some assessment of the disease biology and will potentially weed out or avoid surgery in patients who have particularly unfavorable biology. With most first-line studies, there are very few patients who progress within the first 2 to 4 months. So, in fact, there are only a very few patients who will be found to have such unfavorable biology that if they were de novo resectable, that you would have avoided surgery on some meaningful subset of those patients. There are theoretical issues to inducing some degree of tumor dormancy, to debulking the tumor. It's not clear how much this really matters because there'll need to be some time from when chemotherapy and bevacizumab will need to be stopped before surgery, where presumably drug effects will be reduced or will have worn off at the time surgery is conducted. The other is there may be some delays in scheduling related to the treatment holiday. The other variable is whether or not the patient is unresectable or of borderline resectability. Because the surgical margins usually do not change or don't change significantly, then the value of chemotherapy for downstaging really is limited to patients who are either unresectable, where surgery wasn't an option in the first place, or those who are of borderline resectability, where, for example, a right hepatectomy may become a segmentectomy. That is, it may be a slightly smaller operation.
You know, I've been struggling to try to understand this because we know that, as far as my understanding is, that systemic therapy rarely sterilizes a tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard people talking about, well, maybe it'll pull it away from blood vessels so the surgery's mm-hmm. easier. What exactly is happening that would change the kind of surgery?
Yeah, not being a surgeon, what I'm going to tell you is obviously limited. If the operation is going to be a right hepatectomy, the right lobe's coming out, whether or not the lesion is 2 centimeters or 3 centimeters, as long as it's all in the middle. There are times, however, when the margin of the tumor will abut what would be a crossing of a segment or, as you mentioned, abutment of a blood vessel, where some response may allow a slightly smaller operation to be done and to have negative margins. What is probably still debated is whether or not the margins of the surgery should be driven by the initial staging, and that is if the tumor shrinks, might there still be microscopic seeds present at the original margins, and that's something which is not known. This is exactly why I think you need to have an experienced surgeon in part of this discussion. I think either approach, that is for resectable patients going to surgery and then chemotherapy after, or some degree of chemotherapy before, followed perhaps by additional chemotherapy after surgery, in good hands with, I think, both approaches will probably perform very similarly. And there may be practical issues why one should be done more than another. There may be patients who are very anxious who would like to have the surgery and be done with it. There may be patients where the size of the surgery or the availability of the surgeon may be an issue. For example, patients without a referral surgeon readily available, it may be much easier to start therapy and then work in a lot of the more sophisticated analyses, including PET scans and surgical consultation at a referral center, at the time of subsequent restaging, when everything can be organized and the patient can be prepared for that.
I guess they just had this like 2-3 day conference at the NCI on pre-op therapy for breast cancer, where this has been much more developed. And one of the concepts that was talked about for a long time in breast cancer never seemed to work out was the idea of sort of using it as an indicator lesion pre-op, seeing how patients respond, and particularly if they don't respond at all or they respond not that great, to switch the therapy post-op. Is that something you think would be reasonable to do with liver mets?
I actually don't follow that logic that well. And part of it may be that the number of options we have are more limited and that we've given combination regimens. The regimens are, first of all, fairly active by colorectal standards. And the other issue is, unlike breast cancer, we haven't actually segmented the therapies to see whether singlets or doublets are most useful and then switching. It's an all or none phenomenon, and we haven't really worked out how to tease out whether or not sensitivity to one or of the agents would be appropriate. The other is there may be a bit of a missed opportunity related to curative metastatic resection that makes that potential gamble a little bit different. The notion of sensitivity to chemotherapy, I think, can be approached in some other ways. One is to simply, well, hopefully in a couple years, we'll get to the point of molecular diagnostics being able to give us almost as much information. And like many other settings, there are some trade-offs. The advantage to surgery initially is that when the liver's regenerated, among other convenience factors, once the liver's regenerated, you have healthy liver to then sort of tolerate whatever chemotherapy. The chemotherapy beforehand may have some modest hepatotoxicity. For a few cycles, it's probably not clinically significant with respect to surgical risk. Prolonged therapy, particularly more than 6 months, may pose some risk. What all this means is, at least my understanding of this, is there are so many variables that may have pros and cons in different directions that I think I would keep things, number one, simple, and number two, if there are practical considerations that drive the algorithm to surgery or chemo as the first step, I think it's the execution of either plan that's the bigger difference currently, not which plan is actually used on average.
What about the patient is presenting with a primary tumor and metastatic disease at diagnosis, particularly the patient who has little or no symptoms from the primary?
Yeah, so if it's potentially curative, obviously surgical resection of both should be planned, whether that's concurrent or sequential. I again defer to the surgeons. There has been an increasing trend to do such surgeries concurrently, but mostly that's an issue where I would have a good surgeon make a good decision. For patients with unresectable disease, where the question is how much to worry about the primary and whether or not that needs surgery before starting therapy, there are several considerations. First is that first-line therapy for colon cancer has a response rate that's high enough that usually patients will have a response or at least will not progress quickly in the first month or two. So if one's uncertain, there's not a lot of downside to systemic therapy first. The other consideration is what's causing the biggest problem to the patient. And if at the extremes, where there's a lot of metastatic burden and a relatively small primary that's not symptomatic, then one should probably get on with systemic therapy. The opposite example, where there's limited metastatic burden and limited symptoms from metastatic disease, and there's a primary which has significant bleeding, there's an elevated white count and perhaps fever and point tenderness suggesting perhaps early perforation or abscess, then I think could make the case for doing the surgery and getting that complication of the primary dealt with early so that systemic therapy can proceed with limited interruptions or complexity. For patients in the middle, I think either approach can be used, But with response rates which are high enough, where most patients have their primary respond as well as the metastatic disease, I think there's an increasing bias to be able to treat patients systemically and use the test of time to try to figure out which is the next branch point in the algorithm of their management.
Do we know anything about the response rate in primaries as opposed to, you know, just sort of general response rates in metastatic disease?
No, we don't really know. What we know is that in general, there are not a lot of, we'll call it anecdotes, and the patients having their primary become symptomatic or a problem when they've started systemic therapy. So if one looks across a number of clinical trials, patients who have their primaries in place do not usually run into trouble from the primary location. That may be a bit biased in the sense of those patients likely didn't have a lot of symptoms from the primary and sort of may represent at least a good, if not best case scenario. But what that means is absent a lot of local symptoms, the doctor and the patient probably have a choice. It may be extremely hard to gather the kinds of, you know, very rigorous data, particularly given the variables of size, perhaps local symptoms varying from white count to many other variables, whether it's a right-sided lesion or whether it's left-sided, where there may be higher risk of obstruction.
You know, the NSABP is looking at this question in a phase 2 study, you know, just to sort of, I guess, get a feel for it. And one of the things just sort of thinking about that trial is if you select patients, and of course these people are basically asymptomatic from their primaries, one of the questions it raises is how many of these patients are going to be able to proceed and die of their disease without having had surgery, actually avoiding major surgery and not having a palliative problem locally. Do you have any feeling for whether or not that's going to be rare or common?
I don't know how to put a number on that. I would expect that given the sort of caveats on the large phase 3 studies where patients have had primaries still intact is probably the best roadmap with the caveats of that. The vast majority of patients don't run into trouble from their primary, so I would expect the experience from this study will be that most patients with their primary intact will also not. What's less clear is for patients where the primary may be minimally symptomatic or we'll call it mildly concerning. Again, concern may be in the eye of the beholder. How many of those sort of moderate risk patients will or will not need some surgical intervention?
You referred earlier to the issue of the choice of systemic therapy as first-line metastatic disease. How do you go about making that decision?
So the main issues are, is the patient appropriate for systemic therapy at all? The second would be, are there any major contraindications to the backbone of therapy, which would be either fluoropyrimidine and bevacizumab? Fluoropyrimidine, it's hard to tell other than being sure a quick family history asks if any family member has had chemotherapy and had horrible outcomes, or in the rare patient who may know what their DPD status is.
Have you ever run into anybody who had gave you that history?
One patient.
Interesting. Wow.
If you're a family member of someone who had that, usually everybody in the family then is alerted. Probably half the time it's not a true inherited DPD deficiency, but there are people who, if they have a family member who has a horrific response to chemo, it's something that comes up at every family meeting.
It's a damn good thing to know about in advance, huh?
Yep. The other would be contraindications to bevacizumab, which are mostly relative, although recent arterial vascular complications like a myocardial infarction or stroke or active disease probably represent fairly significant contraindications to bevacizumab.
Recent 6 months? Is that the figure you use?
Yeah, recent's probably a little bit in the eye of the beholder. And a lot probably also depends on the type of event and any management around it. Usually it's 6 months to a year. I think a lot depends on the other variables. So, for example, a non-QMI that had a cardiac stent placed for one lesion and the patient has essentially a normal stress test afterward, is on a statin and a baby aspirin, their risk of an event in the next 12 months on or off bevacizumab is probably less than it was the year before. On the other hand, patients with more complex disease where management is less likely to be useful, I think a relative contraindication is a lot stronger.
In terms of sort of the pathophysiology of how bevacizumab relates to these events, is it actually having the event itself or healing from the event or both?
It's probably the underlying vascular biology that predisposed to the first event that's part of the vasculature. So if you have unstable angina and a plaque is found in one of the coronary arteries, in strong likelihood, the other coronary arteries are diseased as well, both in terms of some degree of modest-sized plaques at different locations. But there are probably other changes in the endothelial cell biology as well, of which plaque and other manifestations are part of the same underlying pathophysiology. And I think that a big part of it has to do with the underlying disease, of which having a known event is largely a descriptor for having bad vessels in general.
So you establish that the patient doesn't have a family history or suspected DPD, that they don't have a major contraindication above, then what?
Right. So these are the relatively easy things. Then the big issue is whether or not which cytotoxic, oxaliplatin or irinotecan, is preferred. And in general, the side effects are comparable enough except for the distinction of neuropathy versus alopecia. And I usually walk the patient through that, and then they get to choose. I think the performance of FOLFIRI bevacizumab, although there's less data, is likely to be identical to FOLFOX bevacizumab. There are issues of the oxaliplatin neuropathy, limiting time on treatment, which may affect final best outcome. I think that can be managed by simply dealing with the oxaliplatin neuropathy when it comes up. That's the long way of saying I think 5-FU irinotecan bevacizumab or 5-FU oxali bevacizumab represent essentially equal choices. And with the recent data from the 966 study, I think capecitabine oxaliplatin bevacizumab is equal to FOLFOX bevacizumab.
Have you been using capecitabine in this situation?
Yeah. And like all other things, I discuss with the patient the pros and cons of pumps and pills, including compliance, and some differences in the side effect profile, including capecitabine obviously having a higher hand-foot syndrome risk. There's the higher diarrhea rate for the capecitabine oxali bevacizumab group as opposed to the FOLFOX bevacizumab group. I think that increased diarrhea rate would be readily manageable with a lower starting dose during the beginning of therapy. And similarly, the FOLFOX regimen has slightly higher neutropenia and neutropenic fever rate, which again is likely manageable by omitting the bolus of the 5-FU.
You mentioned the so-called 66 trial, and the other thing that came out of that, and I can't figure out whether this is just theoretical or actually practical, is the question of whether or not bevacizumab adds as much to an oxaliplatin-containing regimen as it does an irinotecan regimen. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so this becomes extremely complicated very, very quickly.
So make it simple.
I don't think it's oxaliplatin versus irinotecan. If you look at the second-line FOLFOX study from Dr. Giantonio in ECOG, FOLFOX bevacizumab versus FOLFOX versus bevacizumab monotherapy, the benefit in terms of response, progression, survival, with the addition of bevacizumab to second-line FOLFOX, significant, marked, as large as any other study. And that second line is probably a harder to treat population. The first line study with oxaliplatin, I think, is confounded by several clinical study variables. And I think the first important issue is this is exactly why there need to be large randomized studies and why cross-study comparisons need to be taken very, very carefully. One important reason or one likely and important consideration for why the FOLFOX Zelox bevacizumab data do not appear as positive as the bolus IFL regimen, And again, to remind you and the audience, Bolus IFL is not the best platform to use in first-line colorectal cancer therapy. There are several considerations which may have biased the results to appear less than have been seen in other studies, one of which is the definition of progression. And while this seems to be a rather straightforward concept, there are some nuances to the definition, such as, is it disease progression or death, and does that happen during the period while they're on study, or can it happen during some additional period of follow-up? And this is an issue which the audience is likely familiar with, because this is similar to the issue on the 9741 IFL versus FOLFOX study, where some of the progression events actually happened after patients switched whatever their initial therapy was, because they were still under disease control but had become intolerant of whatever their initial therapy had been. The intolerance of therapy is the second confounder, and while it may be beyond what we can cover right now, a very significant number of patients, more than half in the FOLFOX or Xelox bevacizumab arms, stopped their initial therapy for reasons other than disease progression. That is usually intolerance of oxaliplatin. And when that intolerance occurred, in general, patients stopped, a large fraction of patients stopped all protocol therapy, likely so that they and their doctors could have the flexibility of adjusting otherwise first-line types of therapies off study. Now, all of this is a little bit of nuanced, and I think the main issue is this is a reason why cross-study comparisons should generally not be done, or one should be very careful that one's comparing exactly the same parameter. I think these explanations are likely enough that I wouldn't jump to the conclusion that there's a big difference between FOLFOX and FOLFIRI per se. I do think we as American oncologists are still, you know, in the learning curve on how to use oxaliplatin, including how to stop it, take a holiday, use 5-FU alone, and or swap out the cytotoxic, which would be a FOLFOX to FOLFIRI with bevacizumab regimen.
Or use 5-FU plus Bev.
Correct. Or any of the above, depending on how the patient's doing. And what we get into is, depending on when any of these changes are made, we may or may not call that a change in the line of therapy. And because of the conventions we have around lines of therapy, this has very big implications for how we sort of recommend treatments for first or second line and how these sort of data often get recorded by different parties.
In your own practice, what would you guess in terms of the fraction of people that you treat first line who end up getting FOLFOX Bev versus opposed to FOLFIRI Bev?
We've tended to, much like the rest of the country and in part drafting behind the FOLFOX data from the second-line study and first-line practices, probably use a FOLFOX or Xelox regimen in the vast majority of patients first-line. That probably represents some of our habits and biases. I think we've been very careful to adjust and stop oxaliplatin when the neuropathy becomes a problem, and often early enough so that the patient isn't so frustrated with therapy that they want a very prolonged vacation.
What about the issue of actually stopping therapy before symptoms start, or stopping the oxali, for example, and continuing to 5-FU or 5-FU-Bev?
Yeah. So there are a couple ways to manage oxaliplatin neuropathy. One is to be very preemptive, which is sort of on a calendar schedule. This is the Optimox approach, where stopping and starting are based as much on the calendar as on the patient's symptoms or disease control. I find that adjustment based upon the patient's symptoms, as long as the threshold of symptoms is lowered, ends up being nearly identical. And I have a slight bias to try to currently adjust based on how the patient's doing rather than the calendar per se, although I think in practice the two are likely fairly similar.
And when you do stop it, do you continue the 5-FU and Bev or the capecitabine and the Bev?
Yeah. Currently, my algorithm is to reduce or stop the offending agent and to continue whatever parts of therapy seem to be helping as long as they're well tolerated. For patients who need a break from therapy for personal reasons, for asthenia, I think stopping even the 5-FU and bevacizumab for a period of several weeks to 2 months is a very reasonable approach, as long as the disease burden and patient symptoms are consistent with the holiday.
What about the issue of dose of bevacizumab? The second-line trial that you mentioned, E3200, used a higher dose. There was a paper reported at ASCO on non-small cell that used half the dose and seemed like it had the same effect. And we have data in breast cancer and other tumors. Can you kind of put together where we are and where you think we're heading in terms of dose?
The dosing of bevacizumab, I think, can be kept fairly simple. The first issue is that among active doses, that is, whether for colon cancer, the 5 or 10 milligrams every 2 week per kilogram dosing, given the amount of VEGF and the total amount of bevacizumab being given to the patient, differences of a factor of 2, when there are, I'm not sure, 10 to the some very large number molecules of VEGF and 10 to the very large number molecules of bevacizumab, a factor of 2 is probably relatively not a big issue for most patients. There may, of course, be some patients given pharmacokinetic and biological variability where those differences may end up mattering. The point is, I think it will be very hard to see differences when one's comparing two biologically active doses. So number one, for colon cancer, I would conclude that 5 and 10 are both active. And in general, in the first line setting, the starting dose should be 5. For the rare patient that would be appropriate to start second line, I think 10 is appropriate. The harder question is for patients who are on either a prolonged first line or whether there should be some continuation through what might be called second line. My bias is to frame that question that first-line therapy should have a somewhat elastic definition. That is, as long as the patient's tolerating therapy and is on a 5-FU backbone of therapy and has not significantly progressed, they're still in first line. If patients clearly progress on therapy, whatever that therapy is, it should be stopped and patients should be moved on to whatever other therapeutic options seem reasonable. The difficulty is that, particularly if there's slow progression, knowing whether or not that's due to bevacizumab or to the patient's perhaps somewhat indolent disease. And that's why I think this question we have to deal with as best judgment until we get better data. There is a study known as IBET, being run by the cooperative groups, which will actually address this question of whether or not patients do better with bevacizumab continued into that so-called second-line setting, and whether they do better on the 5 versus 10 milligram dose. Those results are needed because otherwise we're going to be debating this till who knows when.
Now, in the patient who has their oxaliplatin stopped in the metastatic setting because of symptomatology, and I'm going to guess that when they progress, you're going to bring in an irinotecan. What exactly do you do with that situation?
If the rate of progression has been very incremental, I think one option would be to sort of swap FOLFOX for FOLFIRI. I think the physician is allowed a little discretion and judgment about whether or not the definition of progression in clinical practice needs to mimic the convention of 20% RECIST progression on a clinical trial, particularly since we may need to adjust for the rate of progression, that is 20% progression over 5 years, is not the same clinical benefit as the rate of progression over 2 months. Similarly, depending on disease burden, whether or not the lesions are all small, such that very minor growth may seem proportionally large, there are settings where I think, you know, there's obviously room for some very obvious clinical judgment. When patients have progressed on first line, I generally switch to second line. So if there's a clear progression on FOLFOX bevacizumab or FOLFOX to 5-FU bevacizumab, most patients I'll switch to irinotecan plus cetuximab. And whether or not that's irinotecan with cetuximab concurrently versus irinotecan followed by irinotecan plus cetuximab, I think is an interesting question, but in general, I tend to use the two concurrently based on the Epic data, although I think that data would also support sequential as well as concurrent use.
For the patient who's had their oxaliplatin stopped because of toxicity as opposed to progression, how often do you later on reintroduce oxali?
If the neuropathy has improved enough that I think the patient's likely to tolerate more than 2 months of therapy, we'll often offer it to the patient.
That's usually later on down the line or not necessarily?
Whenever seems appropriate, mostly based upon symptoms and not unduly complicating whatever their therapy is. So, for example, if their therapy was irinotecan cetuximab, I'm not sure how to incorporate oxaliplatin into those two drugs, but would usually add it back at some later point. The value of adding back later is not entirely clear, and I usually have that be one additional discussion point with the patient. And also realize that many patients, if they've progressed or whatever their next line of therapy is, not all of them will actually be candidates for whatever would be third line or fourth line therapy at that point.
The last thing I want to ask you, that may seem a little bit strange for a program on colorectal cancer, but more from a theoretical point of view in terms of how we do trials that include biologics, is I'm curious what your take was on the presentation at ASCO on sorafenib and hepatocellular carcinoma and what was seen there and what you think it means in general to how we do clinical trials.
The issue of sorafenib in hepatocellular, and to be honest, sorafenib in renal cell, is that patients derive tumor control or progression benefit and survival benefit with a remarkably low response rate. I think it's fairly obvious that response rate, therefore, does not correlate very well with overall survival and progression-free survival. This has a couple implications. The first is this is exactly why we as physicians need to have a bias to use large phase 3 studies and to use particularly survival as the primary endpoint and probably progression-free survival as the next most important endpoint, and why response needs to be valued, but valued in the context. That is, if there's symptom improvement with response or if responses are very durable, that may be a very useful endpoint. But I think it's a sign that we need to bias our value system toward the gold standards of survival and progression-free survival. This has a lot of implications for how we're going to do pilot studies to try to identify hints of activity which merit the kinds of investment and resources and patient and doctor time to conduct large studies. The easiest way around that is when progression is the primary endpoint, there need to be randomized phase 2 designs. The dilemma with progression as an endpoint is that it's often hard to attribute what's due to the drug and what's due to the indolent disease that the patient may have. And in small numbers of patients, minor imbalances in patient or tumor characteristics can easily account for the kinds of progression differences seen. This is really a very straightforward issue. It only has to do with having slightly larger studies to be able to look at progression as an endpoint. Everything is signal above noise. Okay? If there's a dramatic benefit in terms of progression, you don't need a large randomized phase 2 to be able to pick it up. To be honest, if it's a huge difference, you may not even necessarily need to have a randomized design, but that's often helpful for smaller differences. And the issue of how we resource these studies to add slightly higher sample sizes in phase 2 signal-seeking studies is an issue which we as a community just need to figure out. And if the right thing to do to find value to patients is to do progression as an endpoint, and that means randomized phase 2s, then we just need to organize around that. And I think that can be dealt with within the investigators. I think patients will accept this as a design that's in their interest. And from a resourcing point of view, I think the economics of finding successful drugs will warrant slightly larger signal-seeking studies. In fact, you could make the case that from both the patient and the resourcing economically on a larger scale, if we're more accurate in finding drugs which are helpful and in more quickly abandoning drugs which are actually not helpful, the sooner and more efficiently we can do that, that helps everyone, from the patient to the investment banker.